Nathan O. Hatch, the Andrew V. Takis Professor of History, became Notre Dame's provost in 1996, the third person to hold the position since its establishment in 1970. The provost is the university's second-ranking officer and, at the direction of the president, exercises overall responsibility for the academic enterprise of the university. Dr. Hatch had been the university's vice president for graduate studies and research since 1989. Since his appointment, Dr. Hatch has concentrated his focus on three areas: the establishment of academic centers of excellence, including the expansion of the Keough Institute for Irish Studies and the enhancement of the Medieval Institute. Second area, the revitalization of undergraduate education through the creation of the Caneb Center for Teaching and Learning and new opportunities in off-campus and international studies. That's the third area. That's still the second area. And the third area, the pursuit of outstanding faculty. Dr. Hatch also has played an integral role in enhancing the Catholic intellectual life at Notre Dame through the establishment of the Erasmus Center, a center for scholarship informed by Catholic thought. By appointment of President Clinton, Dr. Hatch is a member of the National Council on the Humanities, the 26-person advisory board for the National Endowment for the Humanities, or NEH. Meeting three times a year, the Council reviews grant applications and makes recommendations to the chairman of NEH concerning its policies, programs, and procedures. Appointed to the Takis Chair in 1999 and member of the Notre Dame faculty since 1975, Dr. Hatch regularly is cited as one of the most influential scholars in the study of the history of religion in America. His book, The Democratization of American Christianity, was chosen in a survey of 2,000 historians and sociologists as one of the two most important books in the study of American religion. As Vice President for Graduate Studies and Research, Dr. Hatch instilled a vision of small but superb graduate programs that attracted more and better students to the university, as well as substantial new resources. He oversaw the university's master's degree and doctoral programs and the external funding of research at Notre Dame. Dr. Hatch served as acting dean of Notre Dame's College of Arts and Letters, its largest academic unit, in 1988-89, and from 1983 to 1988 was the college's associate dean. Also during that time, he founded and directed Notre Dame's Institute for Scholarship in the Liberal Arts, which fostered a six-fold increase in external funding of faculty in the humanities and social sciences. A summa cum laude graduate of Wheaton College in 1968, Dr. Hatch earned his master's and doctoral degrees in 1972 and 1974, respectively, from Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Hatch and his wife Julie are the parents of three children: Greg, a 1997 graduate of Notre Dame; David, a class of 2000 graduate; and daughter Beth. I hope you understand how remarkable Dr. Hatch is, not only as a scholar, but as a Protestant, serving as the provost of the most prestigious American Catholic university. We're delighted to have him join us today and look forward to his address. Dr. Hatch.
Good morning. Thank you for that most generous introduction. I'm delighted to be at Brigham Young University today and honored to have the opportunity to address you. I have great respect for this community and your deep commitment to academic excellence in the context of faith. Sustaining learning and faith, inquiry and formation is a high calling indeed, and I commend this university and its leadership for all that you are doing to build a university with this important mission. Yet, if I might be granted a moment of whimsy, I do question why I agreed to come to BYU in March, a time when basketball memories are especially sharp. You see, I grew up in the Carolinas. My father was a Duke graduate, and I have certain mountaintop experiences like going to an ACC tournament or attending the Final Four. But today reminds me of one of the low points in my experience as a Hoops fan. It was the year Danny Ainge was a senior at BYU, and I was a young faculty member at Notre Dame in the early 1980s. The Fighting Irish, intent on the Final Four, had its best squad ever and encountered the Cougars in the regional NCAA finals. As I recall, Notre Dame led the entire game and clung to a one-point margin with 4 seconds remaining. Then Danny Ainge took over. Driving the entire length of the court, 4 seconds seemed like an eternity, he made a last-second layup that remains indelible in the minds of all Irish basketball fans. We in South Bend still wonder why Danny didn't stay with baseball. My topic today is ambition and the soul. Several weeks ago, I was driving in Chicago on the near north side to visit my son, David, who graduated from Notre Dame last June. We don't see David much these days, as he is an analyst with an investment bank in Chicago and works long hours and most weekends. But on this occasion, I was driving from the Loop up towards Lincoln Park, where he lives with 3 other friends, all of whom work in banks in Chicago. As I turned into Clyburn Avenue, about a half mile north of the Loop, I suddenly encountered a scene that I hadn't seen or thought of for over 20 years. There was the Clyburn Gospel Chapel, a small church across the street from the Green Cabrini Homes, that infamous housing project, many of which are now being torn down. What flashed across my mind was the summer of 1967, when I lived in the Clyburn Gospel Chapel between my junior and senior year of college. I spent the weeks of that summer living with 10 other Wheaton students, teaching classes and sponsoring sports activities among the teeming youth of that neighborhood. I have many memories of that long, hot summer, most of them involving intense interactions, whether coaching basketball for those students or teaching them classes, or late-night discussions with my friends about important issues of life and meaning, the nature of the church, the nature of politics. Yet the most vivid memory of that summer was an evening I spent entirely alone. I remember, like it was yesterday, going up on the roof of that church and looking over the skyline of Chicago. That skyline was both alluring and frightening. It represented to me the world that I would soon be facing. Shortly, I would leave the safe confines of a religious college to make my own way. I knew how intensely I wanted to accomplish something, to make a difference in the world. Yet on top of that building, with the immense panorama of Chicago in front of me, I was also aware of my potential insignificance, of how unclear my thinking was of what I wanted to be and to do. I spent that night wrestling with my own ambition. Why am I here? Will I make a difference? What are my gifts? What are my limitations? This morning, many of you Brigham Young students may share the same intensity of concern about your future. My intent is to speak both to those of you for whom the professional path ahead is clear, and more importantly, for those for whom the path is uncertain. My subject today is this: how do young, talented leaders such as yourselves come to terms with ambition? What I have to say may also have some application to those of you who, like myself, are somewhat further along life's path. But for you students, these inner wrestlings are intensified at your time of life, I think, for at least 3 reasons. The first is that you do not know what you can accomplish and how far you can go. Many of you may feel like the young Abraham Lincoln, whose early career, without much distinction, left him with more than his share of self-doubt. From his teenage years onward, Lincoln was keen to advance, pursuing a rigorous program of reading, study, and self-improvement. His law partner, William Herndon, would say later that Lincoln's ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. Yet in 1841, the melancholy Lincoln, doubting whether his life would ever amount to much, confessed to a friend, "I would be more than willing to die, except that I have done nothing to make any human remember that I have lived." All of us aspire to use our God-given talents to do something for which others will remember that we have lived. Second, it is not only self-doubt that shapes ambition when we are young. The fact that we are Americans also brings this issue front and center. The drive that you can make it on your own, that you can be all that you can be, is pretty intense in this culture. We idealize self-made people, those rags-to-riches stories. As Americans, we cherish social mobility and we expect social advance. In America, it seems ambition is very much a part of the air that we breathe. Those of you called to be followers of Christ also wrestle with ambition for a third reason. Yearnings for accomplishment or success can be seen as the siren song of the world. We take seriously our Savior's call and example that to find life we must lose it, that a seed must die before it can live. When the Zebedee family clamored for James and John to occupy seats of honor in the kingdom, our Lord redefined, even inverted, the priorities of his kingdom. What constituted greatness and success? It was to serve, not to be served. In the history of the church, B.H. Roberts reports that Joseph Smith called believers to forego vain and selfish ambition that he saw everywhere, quote, mounting higher and higher. The church needed restoration because, quote, ambitious prelates of an apostate Christianity had gradually supplanted the religion of Jesus Christ. Instead, Joseph Smith called the faithful to follow, quote, the master who had discouraged ambition and had said that he who would be great among his followers must be their minister, and whosoever would be chief among them was to be their servant. The question you face today, which all of us face, and the one that we will continue to face for the rest of our lives, is how do you relate the drive to make a name for yourself with the commitment to honor Christ, that name that is above all names? Are we to nourish ambition as it wells up within our souls, or are we to kill it off? Does ambition constitute a virtue or a vice? Which of these American proverbs are we to heed? Ride your ambition to the skies, or ambition destroys its possessor? How are we to discriminate among ambitions that are proper and those that are inappropriate? In the past, ambition was condemned as unnatural and even immoral. The Latin word ambitio referred to those who would scurry about seeking political favor, drumming up votes rather than letting people recognize the virtuous. In the age of William Shakespeare and John Milton, ambition was equated with the sin of Lucifer or of Adam and Eve, the unlawful desire to be of higher estate than God had intended. Many of Shakespeare's protagonists, like Macbeth, seek to reinvent their identities and thus find themselves cut off from their true selves. "I charge thee, fling away ambition," Shakespeare wrote in the play Henry VIII, "by that sin fell the angels." Ambition in such a culture seemed like rebellion in that society that defines one's identity largely by birth and inherited status. In the modern world, by contrast, and particularly in America, we have come to idealize opportunity, mobility, and progress. Onward and upward has been the prevailing American spirit. We idealize self-made figures like Abraham Lincoln, the rail splitter who became president, or Frederick Douglass, the ex-slave who became an articulate advocate for his people, or Andrew Carnegie and John Rockefeller, who without education or status transformed the scale of American business operations. Within your own tradition, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There is a distinct pantheon of heroes who have accomplished notable things. Business leaders like George Romney, J. Willard Marriott, and Stephen Covey. Education leaders like David Gardner, Kim Clark, and Gordon Lee. Writers like Ann Perry and Brenda Novak. Statesmen like Brent Scowcroft and Orrin Hatch. Scholars like Richard Bushman and Laura Thatcher Ulrich. One cannot imagine the sterling achievements of these individuals had not some blue flame of ambition burned brightly within. So let me return to the central issue. Today, as a student at Brigham Young, it is easy for you to be caught in the vice grip of conflicting expectations, the drive to accomplish great things for noble purpose on the one hand, and on the other, to lose one's life that you may find it. How does one cope with this abiding tension? This morning, let me offer five simple words of advice. First, I don't think we can stifle ambition itself. Your finest hopes and dreams come from the very core of your being. Those energies and drives are there, and I think you're burying your talents if you do not use them. The process of suppressing ambition reminds me of what Dorothy Sayers said about trying to force a large and obstreperous cat into a small basket. As fast as you tuck in the head, the tail comes out. When you have confined the hind legs, the forepaws come out and scratch. And when, after a painful struggle, you finally shut the lid, the dismal wailings of the imprisoned animal suggest that some essential dignity has been violated and wrong done to its nature. The drive to accomplish is a good gift of God. The question, what are your ends? What are your means, and by what measures you judge success? My first point, then, is I don't think we can simply suppress ambition. But my second is different. I think the ambitious path is a dangerous one. Ambition is not easily distributed, as Joseph Epstein has noted. He said, some people burn with it while others are apparently wrapped in asbestos and never feel its heat. For those of you who, like Lincoln, whose ambition is a little engine that does not seem to rest, you will trod a path of great opportunity, but of also certain perils. Let me mention two reasons why I think ambition's road is a dangerous one. First, success rarely quenches ambition's thirst. Benjamin Franklin, an ambitious man if ever there was one, noted that ambition never has the good fortune to satisfy us. Its appetite grows keener by indulgence. Two of the most famous people I know seem to hunger for achievement and recognition long after they have made it right to the top. To me, it seems odd and sad that after all their well-deserved achievements, they could not simply relax and revel in what they had accomplished. At retirement age, one of these persons was bitterly disappointed at not receiving another presidential appointment. So that's one reason why I think it's a dangerous path. That is, success rarely seems to slake ambition's thirst. But there's another. Being driven to succeed often stems for a desire for belonging and appreciation. As C.S. Lewis once noted, our longing to be part of an inner circle, to hear a profound well done. Yet the style of ambitious people often repels those around us whose esteem and love we crave. How often have you secretly wished that the person who breaks the curve, who wins the race, who is most popular, will somehow have clay feet? I recall vividly the experience of the golfer Greg Norman, who came to know the adulation of fans not when he was winning, but after experiencing a devastating collapse of his game in the Masters tournament. People could identify him not when he was on top, but when he was needy. Overt success easily backfires. Seeking affirmation and belonging, it easily generates distance from other people. So I think ambition is a dangerous path because it rarely satisfies in and of itself, and because ambitious behavior distances us from those who love and affection we crave. Let me make a third point about ambition. Be ruthless and sober in scrutinizing your own ambition. At Notre Dame, we had a wonderful assistant dean who for 40 years advised pre-law students. Bob Waddick was an old Navy salt who called us spade a spade. He deflated more pretension and naive students than anyone I know. He would look at a student's ability, their record, their work habits, and tell them exactly what level of law school to which they should apply. Bob was so true and honest with other law schools that all of them unfailingly accepted those students he would recommend. All of us need this kind of ruthless advice from time to time. The American myth that we can make ourselves anything we want sometimes allows our reach to exceed our grasp. In the Christian community, where we are called upon not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought, it is even more imperative to form our identity in a careful process of listening and seeking advice. It is also important to scrutinize professional ambition with respect to how it affects other dimensions of life. President David O. McKay offered sterling advice when he said, "No success in business can compensate for a failure in the home," a phrase that Dean Kim Clark of Harvard Business School often gives to MBA students there. The problem for young people entering business and the professions is this: right out of school, the most formative influence in your life may be that profession itself. This world of work can easily embrace you with a grip more powerful and alluring than anything you have known in church, family, or friends. It can be your law firm, your investment bank, your medical practice, your television station, your consulting group, which will consume most of your waking hours and exact your most creative energies. Your profession will tell you when to get up in the morning, what neighborhood you should live in, what to wear to work, where to take clients to lunch, and what kind of organizations you should join. To excel as a lawyer today, a scientist, a research physician, an investment banker can easily demand exclusive loyalty. The time, energy, and commitment required to excel in these arenas make it very difficult to balance with other priorities, family, church, community. I think the issues are even more acute for young women in religious traditions such as your own. Your education and ability draw you naturally towards professional excellence. At the same time, you also seek to sustain religious commitments that make home and family of highest priority. Balancing these competing claims for men and women alike will require great wisdom and forbearance. A fourth point. Ambition springs up in the most unlikely places, even in religious organizations and institutions. In those contexts, ambition often takes on a more subtle form. In a religious culture, many will never admit that they are ambitious, even if others around may perceive patterns of ambitious actions. In a business organization, it is often a liability not to express ambition for more responsibility, wanting the next higher position. In a religious one, as in most universities, overt interest in leadership is generally frowned upon and rarely discussed. Yet we would be naive to think, to act as if ambition, our own and that of our peers, were not powerful forces in shaping religious organizations. For those of us who work in places like Notre Dame or Brigham Young, we must seek extra scrutiny to our own ambitions. We must check and channel those powerful subterranean currents, even if in public they're rarely acknowledged. We must make sure that our dreams for an organization are directed to the common good and not to our own good. And we must make sure that we serve in word, not just in word, but also in deed. My fifth and final word of advice about ambition is this: who you are, your core identity, has nothing to do with how successful you become. Our culture forces a tight link between success and identity. Your accomplishments give you worth. Modern professional life reinforces a sense that success is the measure of all. The professions are a meritocracy of good works. A right diagnosis leads to a successful cure. A sound legal argument will win the case. The correct design of a bridge will make it withstand traffic. That's all well and good. Who can argue with it? The problem is that success easily becomes the measuring stick for everything in our lives. Life becomes a bookkeeping scheme of merit and reward. We applaud success in ourselves and like to rub shoulders with other successful people. All too easily, business people and professionals get to the top of the heap, congratulate themselves, and subtly look down on others. The problem with this ethic of success is that it stands in collision course with how God treats his people and calls us to treat each other. Christ did not come into the world to save those who were doing well, who could help themselves. He came to save those who were troubled. The clarion call of Joseph Smith and of Brigham Young was for a reconstituted church which would not be a respecter of persons, but would embrace everyone and take care of everyone. Success is dangerous for the Christian because in its grip we can easily judge ourselves and each other by a yardstick that's very different from that of which Christ requires. This morning I've attempted to bring some perspective to the reality of ambition in our lives. I've suggested first that ambition is not something that we can merely suppress. Second, that ambition is a dangerous path because success rarely slakes the thirst, and because ambitious people often put off those people whose affection they crave. Third, I've suggested that ambition needs regular scrutiny. And fourth, that it is a reality everywhere, even in religious contexts. My final point, which I wish to underscore, is that our identity is not based on how successful we are. All of us, those who are driven and those who are more relaxed, those at the top of the class and those who struggle, those who relish the future and those who are gripped with fear, all of us derive our worth from the fact that God in Christ calls us to be his sons and daughters and welcomes us into the banquet of his kingdom. Our identity does not rest on our fickle ability to climb some organizational ladder, but in the embrace of God and of his people. Any of our own achievements will pale before those priceless treasures. Thank you very much.